Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jane Donahue. Today we continue our annual broadcast of presentations from the College of the Atlantic Summer Institute in Bar Harbor, Maine. Every year, the College of the Atlantic Summer Institute invites speakers to address a topic relevant to our times. This year's theme was Pathbreaking: Pioneers, Innovators, Leaders. Today's episode is the fifth in a six-part series. The final episode will air tomorrow. Navreena Singh, founder and CEO of Credo AI, a platform that helps companies use AI responsibly, believes that with the right guardrails, AI can be a powerful tool for good. She's joined by CEO of The Atlantic, Nick Thompson, for a discussion of the opportunities AI presents and how to ensure it's used safely and fairly. This talk was recorded live on August 1st, 2025.
Navreena, you grew up in rural-ish India. Your father's a police officer, middle-class family. Tell me about your first computer.
Oh, very interesting. Just fact-checking, my dad was actually in the Indian military for 40 years, not a police officer. And my mom was a teacher-turned-fashion designer. So as you can imagine, between both of them, there was literally 0 ounce of science. So I didn't even get my first computer till I was 16. And so you can imagine when I get my first, I don't even remember which, it was some Intel chip powered a computer, but the first thing I did was I actually opened it up rather than using it. Because I was very always curious.
Wait, you like unscrewed it?
Not only unscrew it, I completely like took apart that computer because I wanted to see what's inside it and how it does its magic.
Did you not know how to turn it on, or you were just like...
Great question. I knew how to turn it on, but I think I was just very curious around how does it actually connect to the rest of the world. And so as someone who grew up in a place where you didn't have access to much technology, a lot of, I think, my questions emerged from what's inside it and how does it do the things that it does. And so, yes, that was not well received by my parents, as you can imagine. You know, they come to my room,
okay,
everything's taken apart.
Did you put it back together?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
And I think that's the best part.
And did it still turn on after you did that?
It did, and it did its job. And I think I've gotten my... Thank you. But you have to know that I was already in high school by that time. I was really into sciences. And for anybody who knows about India, growing up, there were only two professions. You either become a doctor or an engineer. So my path was kind of set, but gladly, I was always very curious about solving big problems using technology. So yes, broke a lot of things at home growing up, including electric panels. Like I just felt I could fix everything. So yeah, the building we lived in were really not thrilled that I would just go and like tamper with all the electric panels all the time. So
you learn about the computer, you're excited, you're heading on a path towards engineering. Not the easiest thing for a woman in India, since some complexities around men, female, and the engineering path. We'll get into that. You then come to this country and you come to, I can't remember, you told me, we talked about it, University of Wisconsin-Madison?
Yes, I did.
And you come at what age?
19.
19. And so you're an undergraduate.
Yeah.
And you go into computer science there?
I did computer science and electrical engineering. Again, I'm a very hands-on person. I have to feel technology to be able to figure out what it is. So I was enamored by hardware engineering and I wanted to build chipsets. So I went and did my master's in electrical and computer engineering in Madison, Wisconsin, obviously because I had full scholarship and they had great cheese and beer. So all of that worked out.
Excellent. Okay. Beer and electrical engineering goes really well together in Navreena. Okay. So you leave Madison, you get your degree, and you end up at Qualcomm. So that's your first big tech job. Tell us what you were doing at Qualcomm and tell us about how you started to uncover the power of AI.
Yeah, absolutely. So for those who don't know, how many of you have a cell phone? I know, wrong question. How many of you have two cell phones? See, that's a good test.
But, how many of you don't have a cell phone?
See.
Okay.
That's
my kid.
Wow, Dad, you got to do something about it, right?
Absolutely not.
Yeah. Well, if you have a cell phone, you have technology that Qualcomm built, and primarily technologies that I worked on very early on in my career. So after graduating, joined Qualcomm, working on what's called hardware chips or mobile phone chips. I was in the research and development team there. It's not the most exciting, you know, technology, but it powers everything and the way it connects the world. So did that for about 13 years. I was the head of innovation at Qualcomm. And it was during those 13 years, there was a massive transformation happening in the technological world. And the massive transformation that was happening was we were getting really powerful computer systems, especially GPUs, which primarily were used for gaming. And in 2011, suddenly researchers figured out that they can actually be used for deep learning. So that's one shift that happened in 2011. The second shift that happened in 2011 is one of my favorite researchers, Dr. Fei-Fei Li, created the first massive data set. I think it was about 16 million images, which were all labeled by her research lab. So now you have this really powerful hardware, your GPUs. You have a massive amount of data, which has been labeled by humans. And now you're applying these neural networks, which have existed for 50 plus years, but now with the compute and data are able to do many amazing things. And so at Qualcomm, created the robotics business, and we built the first set of robots that were launched in supply chain for cell phones.
Let's go back to the Fei-Fei Li data set. First, yeah. Explain very briefly what a neural network is, and then secondly, explain, I mean, her work is identifying images. What does building chips have to do with that?
Oh, great, yes. So neural networks, the best way to think about it is, you know, our brain. Our brain has a bunch of neurons. When they connect in certain ways, we are able to reason, we are able to identify patterns, we are able to make decisions, we are able to be intelligent. So AI,
sometimes.
Some of us, yes.
Sometimes.
Sometimes, but also some of us, right? So, and in artificial intelligence, the whole idea is there a way that we could have these neurons replicated in machines so that these machines can not only reason over data and the way that humans are able to make associations and start making decisions, can these machines over time develop human-like intelligence? So neural networks essentially is the algorithm and the way that these systems are created so that they can actually make these decisions. And the reason hardware and data and all these components become really critical for AI is to be able to make simple decisions, especially machine-led decisions, it needs massive amount of compute. It needs large amount of hardware and computational capabilities so that you can actually make these decisions and associations faster and efficiently. And so hardware becomes really critical, is the baseline on which you run these neural networks, and data is like what's feeding these neural networks to identify patterns, like is it a dog, is it a cat, is
wait,
it
wait, so that's super interesting. Okay, so you see Fei-Fei's data set, you see that people, I mean, part of what people realized is she built the data set, it's not just there's a cool data set, but oh my God, machines can identify objects as well as humans can, and it was this, and also neural networks, which, you know, this sort of academic idea that a bunch of people were pushing, but no one really believed would totally work, it's going to work. So then you had the insight, we should optimize hardware for this?
Yes. So we were actually, and this is a very interesting
use case. If you had been able to convince Qualcomm completely, it would now be worth as much as NVIDIA, which would have made you a trillionaire. But sorry, go on.
No comments. So it was a very fascinating problem. And if you will give me like 5 minutes to explain the problem. There's a manufacturing plant in Japan that builds cell phone chips. And if you have the cell phone, it has an LCD screen on it. And essentially, in this manufacturing plant, you have humans after humans after human, and their job is basically to pick up this new cell phone and figure out if there is a dead pixel. That means, does the LCD screen work? So imagine day in, day out, you're staring at these phones, not one, not two, millions of phones in a day. And so the impact of that is actually on human eyesight. So what we found in this manufacturing plant, which was fascinating, Nick, is generally the employees only had like a 2-year lifetime. That means because their eyesight was getting impacted, they were constantly looking at these phones. So, and to figure out a dead pixel, it would take them anywhere from 5 to 6 minutes, like if this screen is built right or not. we were able to replace that with a collaborative robot using the computer vision technology that we created with some of the work that Dr. Fei-Fei Li had done. And we were able to figure out this deck pixel using the robot in less than 5 seconds. But the advantage was there was no human labor involved. Now, humans actually could be on much higher order task in the supply chain. And so they were able to stay with these manufacturing plants longer. I mean, imagine you're helping humans, you're bringing productivity, you're bringing efficiency, but then there were safety concerns. You have these massive robots. These are these big arms, which we weren't able to optimize for. And they're working side by side with humans. And there were times when these arms would literally be uncontrollable and they might hit a human. So it was literally physical safety threats. And that's when I got really interested in this notion of AI safety, like not only in physical world, but in digital world, what does safety mean for AI?
So you helped build this tool, which is magical for saving human eyesight, moving humans to higher efficiency tasks, and great for humans unless they lose their jobs or get clawed to death by a giant robot. Okay, great. So that gets you interested in AI safety, which then leads you to Microsoft and to Credo. Let's follow that step.
So again, you know, it's very interesting as an engineer, and especially as someone who is a renegade in technological areas. I was always looking at where the puck is going. And this was around 2011, 2012, after machine learning started to take off or AI started to take off. The next evolution really was happening on the cloud side because everything was moving away from you trying to have a computer in your house or in your business and everything going into the cloud. And the leader in that space was Microsoft, like moving to cloud. And so joined Microsoft and initially was responsible for what's called cognitive services. These were, again, a set of capabilities, AI powered, everything from facial recognition to speech recognition to building chatbots that were going to help businesses get on cloud faster. So ended up joining Microsoft. And as you can imagine, machine learning and AI started to take off with cloud adoption. And then we had an incident. This is the beautiful part of being a technologist. The incident was there was a chatbot launched by Microsoft. It was called Tay. It was launched on Twitter, and it went from zero to racist in less than 16 hours. So, I mean, right here, imagine as technologists, you're like...
And not just racist, like Hitler racist.
Yeah, so, I mean, any kind of racist, I think, is really bad. But yes, that it took it,
it like
to
followed the whole trajectory of Kanye's career, right? Like within 16 hours.
And I think that was, you know, as a technologist, there are certain moments in your career where it's not just about building cool products or cool technology. It really is around, am I doing the right thing? It's all about responsibility and accountability. And so there were a bunch of these moments after I got into AI in 2011 that I just started to like question, like, I'm like, oh, who is going to make sure that these systems work in service of humanity? Who's going to ensure that, you know, our kids get the right education? Who's going to ensure that, you know, women get into engineering jobs, which, by the way, growing up was really hard? How do we make sure that, you know, we still are able to leverage technology and not eradicate it from getting the benefits in this economic, you know, society because of technology? So all these questions, I would say, started to really take shape. And the other big thing was, you know, there was no stopping. There was just this question around how can we build faster and how can we like get the benefits faster? So someone had to do something, and why not me, right? So
you certainly fixed that problem. All right, so you see, and just a reminder that all of this is happening well before ChatGPT gets released. So it is well before the world recognizes just how crazy this tech is going to be. So you leave Microsoft and you found Credo. What year was that? And what does the company do?
Yeah. So, and there's an important in-between period. So I was at Microsoft and I had the opportunity to join Mozilla board. And for those who don't know Mozilla, I think one of the core beliefs I have is technology really needs to be open sourced and there needs to be a way that we bring in community so that we can build better on it. And being part of the Mozilla board was such an honor because I saw firsthand the impact that communities, researchers, even like people from non-technological background can have on this technology. And a big part of, you know, Mozilla board work was launching Mozilla AI. So a lot of different things are happening. Like, by the way, it's not just one thing. It's like, oh my God, there's this racist bot. Oh my God, nobody's doing anything about safety. Wow, what a great opportunity in open source. And so this was around 2019. And of course, my timing is always perfect. So a week before shelter in place in California, I decided that why not leave Microsoft and start a safety company? So I started Credo AI in March of 2020 with one strong belief. And the belief was, I think this AI technology, whatever form it takes, we were in very early innings of AI at that time, really needs to have the right guardrails. It really needs to have the right governance. It needs to have oversight, whether it is human oversight or AI oversight, but someone's got to do something about it. And so Credo AI was really born from this, you know, my 20-year career, seeing that as technologists, sometimes we don't take responsibility, and I wanted to change that.
All right. So great. You found Credo, takes off. By the way, she's not going to say this. They just raised at $100 million valuation last year. This company is doing quite well. All right. So you found the company. This is before it is worth hundreds of millions of dollars or $100 million. What do you sell? And let's make it specific. Let's say the College of Atlantic wanted to start using AI to vet applicants, right? Which is fraught, could lead to bias, can lead to problems. How could Credo help?
Yeah. I'm going to try and simplify it because I think at the end of the day, the goal of Credo AI, our software platform, is to figure out issues or risk within AI systems, mitigate those risks, and get it to compliance with AI standards or regulations that might exist. But a big component of governance is risk and risk identification. So let's assume that Atlantic is using a third-party AI tool, and they're using the third-party AI tool to determine who should be hired at Atlantic. Now, you will be surprised the third-party AI tools right now that are getting built, they are built on data sets. And these data sets is basically sourced from different places, but many companies don't do their due diligence in figuring out, are these diverse enough data sets? And what that means is, let's assume that you're trying to hire an engineer, and obviously this is a deeply personal topic to me, but there are certain characteristics that technology companies look for in an engineer. And many of those characteristics are actually not represented, especially by women. And they are not represented, especially by brown women. So what ends up happening is now you have this neural network, this system that you've trained on data set, which is literally showing there is this category of people, men, most of the time it's men, that make for good engineers. Now, if you use this algorithm in Atlantic, guess what you've just done? I can't get a job with Atlantic. And you've just deprived me of this massive opportunity to actually bring massive impact to Atlantic. So our system, our company's software figures out, are your systems actually fair? Are they leaving certain demographics out? As an example, we, by the way, manage right now 600 risks in AI, so I can talk about all those 600 risks, but fairness is one important risk. Where we are trying to figure out, are your systems are unfairly treating certain demographics, and because of that, you're not making the right decisions for your business.
So this gets super interesting, right? And so let's say a company signs up, and they sign up, and they want to audit, and they want to make sure that they have an applicant pool, and it's, you know, and they use Credo to make sure that the algorithms they've got don't have gender biases built into them. How do you determine whether they've actually reached the right level? Is it if it's screening 50% women? Are you trying to rectify historic injustices, in which case maybe it should be 70% women, but maybe actually, maybe ask you, it's a company where women really succeed, so it should be 90. Maybe it's a company where men do better because of the culture or because of the geography or because it's based, you know, inside a men's club, right? Like, how do you determine what is the exact right number of applicants and how do you determine whether it's biased or not?
Great question. And this is where this becomes even more nuanced and complex discussion. As an example, if Atlantic in New York is hiring, guess what? You have to comply with the law, which is called local law number 144. And that law literally states that based on certain, you know, technical metrics that you have to measure, you have to meet the forfeits rule, which was established in 1972. So I think what is your threshold is basically determined by your company, like Atlantic, or is determined by laws and regulations where you're operating, or by standards. The important thing is not only those thresholds, but are you disclosing it to the candidates who are applying? So there's a big part of consumer trust that you have to build, where Atlantic, once they post a job description, there should be a disclaimer that says, hey, by the way, we are using AI tools to make a determination on which candidates go through. That's disclosing. Second is you have to make some sort of like an audit disclosure, especially in New York, that you've done this bias testing and that your system is actually following those rules. So it's that's where the nuance comes in. It's not, is it this or that? It's not a binary decision. It's actually dictated by the company.
So somebody else sets the rules. So we have to comply by New York State's rules. You're making sure that we comply by them, not by some sort of credo-determined band of justice.
No, and it is also determined by your company policies. Like, what does Atlantic care about? Our hope is over time we become the seal of good AI. But right now, as a young startup, we are not in a place to say, hey, this is what good looks like.
Have you ever been in a situation where you've had a company that has been using an algorithm that is biased, but biased in the direction that you consider justice? Let me give you an example. I have a friend who was working in AI, and I'm going to blur the details for obvious reasons. And they were helping design a sentencing algorithm for a southern state. And what they did is they figured that sentencing guidelines were racist because you've trained on racist data. And so in general, you know, black people are going to be sentenced for a longer crime than white people. And so they countered that. And they're like, okay, so we'll sort of adjust it so that everybody gets the same. And then they were like, you know what? We're just going to kind of tweak it behind the scenes so everybody gets lower sentences because that's our definition of justice. And so they then sell this algorithm to the state, and the state, lo and behold, doesn't know it, still doesn't know it, which is why I'm blurring the details, is like letting everybody free. Have you ever been in a situation like that?
Many times. So I think one of the
challenges... So what is the most illegal and most interesting one? Chatham House rules here, Navrina.
Oh,
maybe.
Yeah. Do you serve wine in the morning? I'm just curious because I think that conversation needs to happen at the cocktail hour. But jokes apart, I think this is the challenge. You know, it's a big part of challenges we are encountering in AI is because it's very reflective of the society we live in. It's trained on data sets that are basically curated by us. So it is basically a mirror to the society. And so I think that's why it's very nuanced. It's very contextual. So there's not one like right or wrong answer, right? I think you're hearing this narrative, and we can go into the AI action plan very quickly in a bit. This truth-seeking AI. Whose truth? Who is determining that truth? These are complex challenges. So one of the things that Credo AI does and our software really focuses on is we call it context-specific AI risk identification. And what context means is, as an example, you might be using ChatGPT in schools here, and kids might be using it for writing an essay. Now, you can use the same foundation model for actually making the hiring decision. Very different context of use. One is an essay co-pilot, and the other one is a hiring decision, which can have a lot of implications, as we discussed. So the context matters, and within that context, what does risk mean, and what does compliance mean needs to be defined. And so this is where Credo AI software comes in, because everything is contextual.
All right. Excellent. So now we all understand Credo. We all understand Navrina's background. Let's go into big questions in AI. I'm just going to ask you some big questions, and you're going to answer them, okay?
Oh, wow. These were small questions before?
Question number one, education and AI. So I asked Everett in the green room, how does the College Atlantic use AI? And he said, well, you know, some people are kind of scared of it and kind of want to have it go away, and some people are into it. And what is the right philosophy for a university and for a professor on how to use AI in teaching their kids?
That's a great question. And I think if you're going to be afraid of AI, you should already consider yourself irrelevant in the future. I don't think any of us, I have an 11-year-old daughter. She's already proficient in using AI tools. Obviously, she has me as the overseer of how she uses it. But like the conversation that I have with her is she has to be AI forward and she has to be AI informed, because I don't see a future in which people who don't understand this technology, don't use it, are actually going to have a future that is prosperous, that is productive, that is efficient. And so I have had the opportunity to be on the board of University of Wisconsin College of Engineering, and also on the USC. They have an ethical AI board, which is really amazing. And both USC and Wisconsin are really rethinking their curriculum. They're rethinking their education program, because now you can't wait to learn AI and these capabilities. This is like base level education, and it has to start as early as in middle school or maybe even sooner. And so, and if kids and education are not evolving with artificial intelligence, and if schools are not adopting it faster, honestly, I would be very concerned for the future.
Next big question. How powerful do you think it's going to get? And I'm going to tell two stories, and I want you to choose which one is more correct. Okay. So story number one, AI is improving on an exponential curve. A couple years ago when ChatGPT came out, it was kind of like smart as like, I don't know, a high school student who made stuff up. Now it's as smart as like a PhD student with amnesia, right? Like soon it's going to be as smart as a Nobel Prize winner, and then it's going to be even smarter than that. And in fact, once you have machines that can invent the next machines, you're on an even further exponential curve. This is story number one, right? Like this is the, you know, situational awareness curve, right? We are in this moment of change, and it is a very brief moment in 2025, 2026, where you can actually hold on to it. But by 2027, 2028, you know, hyperdrive. Story A. Story B. Yeah, this stuff is cool, right? But it's fundamentally extremely limited, right? They still hallucinate. They still make mistakes. You actually can't hand things off to an agent for more than a two-step process. And the improvement curve is going to hit an asymptote, because you've trained on human documents. You're not going to be able to get much more intelligent than humans. And there's kind of a bubble, right? And if you look at the run rate of how much profit these companies should be making on NVIDIA chips, and you look at how much profit they're making, clearly this isn't sustainable. There's going to be a crash. There's going to be a reduction in investment. And yes, this stuff is going to be really important, but like, come on, it's never going to be smarter than us. So story A or story B?
You know, I've never been good at predicting the future, but I've always been good at creating the future.
No, you have been. You nailed it, right? Like you got it right years ago.
And I think that's the distinction I was mentioning. Like I don't predict the future. I actually create it. And I would say that right now, based on creation, I would say scenario A is more likely, just where, you know, the capabilities we are seeing in AI systems. I think the question is not just the capabilities, but usefulness. I think that's where I might differ a little bit. The capabilities are accelerating based on your scenario A. A big part of usefulness is grounded in, do you have the right governance? Can you trust this technology? Can it actually work independently? This whole world of AI agents that, by the way, we've already entered into like maybe 6 months back, is a very scary world, because now you have these systems actually already interacting without any human intervention. And in this new world where they have the AI systems have agency, the key question is, how are we making sure that they're aligned to our goals and they're actually executing on our objectives? So we've already entered that phase, Nick. So I think the question is it useful and is it sustainable? And that is something that we are trying to make happen. I think it's going to be useful only if it has the right governance and oversight. And is it going to be sustainable? That one I'm still questioning about, because of the compute required and obviously the energy consumption required for some of these systems.
All right, well, let's go to big question three, the energy required, right? This college has done incredible work on environmental issues. Amazing, wonderful place. There is a fear that all the progress that we have made on climate change in the last decade is going to be wiped out by AI, right? So it's, you know, 100 times, you know, more energy intensive to do a search on ChatGPT than on regular Google. Is AI going to be net positive for climate change, because it will so accelerate the speed of science and so accelerate the speed at which we can, you know, figure out ways to make our trucking fleet more efficient and figure out how to suck down carbon dioxide from the atmosphere? Or is it going to be a disaster because of the energy requirements?
Nick, do you know founders well? We are very optimistic people. So again, I'll go with your scenario one, because having said that, I'm not an expert on this area, especially the work that is being done in you know, climate change and use of AI, I really hope it is the first scenario.
All right, next big question. So there are lots of reasons why women are blocked from becoming executives of AI companies, right? And there are all kinds of problems in the pathway. Some are directly related to tech, some just directed to gender politics. But one of the data points that I find the most confusing is if you look at like the Brookings surveys, the McKinsey surveys, it's not just that women are becoming executives of AI, they use AI less. Like they use ChatGPT less. And inside of companies, they use it less. And so that is like an additional problem that's going to make gender equity worse. Why is that and how do you solve it?
I honestly don't know because I'm like a, such an AI forward person, but I you are right, by the way. And I think maybe if I was to just, you know, based on my experiences, I think women, I think most women want to just do a lot of good. And so when they see these technologies that may not be getting the right outcomes, might not be performing as expected, I think they just shy away from using that technology. So I mean, that's the only reason I can say that women are a little bit shy of using AI, but we actually highly promote that irrespective of your gender, you should be using more and more AI because if you don't use it, if you don't understand it, you can't govern it. And that's a big belief that we have.
Wait, so you feel that like because these systems BS, right? Like men are
not all the time, but yeah, many times.
It kind of is like next token prediction will inevitably lead to a certain amount of BS. Yeah. You feel like men are kind of more comfortable navigating that environment than women?
I would say men, I have found, at least in my 25 years in tech, men are more okay with experimenting and failing than women. Women don't like to fail. We like to win. And I think that this technology and this testing with technology needs a very experimental mindset. It does need a lot of iteration. It needs okay failing. Maybe that's one of the things that might be preventing women, but I actually don't know the exact reason.
That's an extremely interesting hypothesis that I have not heard. I find this one just bewildering, right? Because, yeah. And it's, if you believe like I do and like you do, that anybody who doesn't use AI is going to be left behind, it's not a good thing.
I totally agree, Nick. And this one, I really think we should dig deeper because I was looking at some of the stats in terms of, you know, not just, especially in, you know, middle school and high school, again, boys using AI much more frequently now with schoolwork than girls. And this was a new Harvard study, which is really fascinating. And I don't know the reason. It's just fascinating.
Well, I mean, that one's interesting because if you're using AI with your schoolwork and you're using it as a tutor, right? And you're using it to like, as my children do, like my eldest son is, you know, can I log into ChatGPT? Ellis, you're at school. Why? And he's like, I have a question about the Spanish Revolution, right? And you're using it to understand things you don't understand. That is amazing. If you're using it to reproduce and cut short the learning process, then you actually are going to kneecap yourself, right? So the trick is to be able to use AI in a way that makes you smarter, more curious, and understand the world better, not to shortcut the learning process. So actually, maybe if in school the boys are using it more, it's a weirdly school is where the boys are behind. This is kind of an interesting, complex question.
You know, I was really impressed with the dean of Harvey Mudd, Maria Clave, a couple of years ago. And one of the things that she did, which was fascinating, was she found that a lot of women were not entering computer science and not sticking with it once they came to computer science. And she was like, what is going on? And, you know, and so she did an evaluation of a curriculum. And one thing that she found was initially the curriculum was just about programming computers and maybe writing some software. But when she actually changed the curriculum to impact, how do you actually write build a software program that can help with education? Or how can you build something which can help with women's health, something impact related? She was able to see not only an increase in girls going into computer science, but also sticking with computer science. And so I think there's some correlation there around impact and technology, which I would say women get excited about. And so we need to bring maybe that angle to AI as well.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's show is the fifth in our six-part series featuring speakers from the 2025 College of the Atlantic Summer Institute. Stay with us as Credo AI founder and CEO Navreena Singh and CEO of The Atlantic Nick Thompson discuss the future of AI and take audience questions. This conversation was recorded live on August 1st, 2025 in Bar Harbor, Maine, and has been edited for broadcast.
Trump just laid out an AI action plan. There's a number of executive orders. Why don't you walk through what you think? You're still advising the White House, right?
I can't disclose it.
Okay. Tell me what you like most about the bill or what is most important about the AI action plan.
Yeah, so just for a little bit context for those who are not tracking, last week was a pretty pivotal week. The AI action plan came out of the current administration. It's a 23-page read. Highly encourage all of you to read it because I think it's actually very well drafted. It's well drafted.
Totally agree.
Very well drafted from the perspective of making it understandable by everybody, not just technologists, not just by policymakers. So that's like really awesome. The second thing, I think there's a lot of overlap with what has been done over the past couple of years with the previous administration as well. A big focus for the action plan is around AI adoption. But, you know, if you just read the action plan, it's all grounded in governance and trust. How can we actually have evaluation methodologies so that we can trust these systems? How can we invest more in open source so that the research community is contributing to it? How can we actually collaborate more on international standards, obviously using some of the baseline standards that have been developed in the United States and build on top of it. So I think there are some really exciting elements of the AI action plan. A big focus of this AI action plan is on AI adoption. It is on United States winning in AI, with AI, with bringing in some of our allies together. So I would say, you know, when I was actually part of the first executive order under President Biden, as part of the National AI Advisory Commission, and, you know, it was 163-page long executive order, and this 23-page long AI action plan, the components are very similar. The big, I would say, shift that we are seeing is the focus. Rather than just focusing on risk, there's a focus on accelerating AI adoption, but with governance and with trust central to it. So again, I think I am actually very heartened to see this AI action plan and the focus on, again, governance and trust.
So you're not going to be able to critique the AI action plan, but why don't we do this? Why don't I tell you, I'll go through things I like and why I like them, and you tell me whether I'm right or wrong. You know much more about it than I do, and then I'll tell you things I don't like and whether you're right or wrong. So should I start with don't like or like? Don't like. So part of the action plan, and in fact, it's overall, I was actually pretty into this action plan, right? The Atlantic has not fully endorsed Donald Trump, even though his inclusion of us in his Signal chats has been great for circulation. But I think a lot of the folks who advise him on AI are awesome, right? And I think they're really smart. And I think there's it's a very impressive document. So what I don't like. There, in the very beginning, and then at the end, there's this demand that AI be audited for wokeness, right? And the idea is that it's anti-ideological, right? And that previous AIs were kind of woke and pushing diversity, you know, pushing radical climate agenda. And my view is actually the job of the government is never to dictate ideology. And saying something is anti-woke or can't be woke is dictating an ideology, even if what you're saying is you're not dictating an ideology. In fact, so now all these AI companies are going to be like, God, it's like my AI, is it advocating solar panels? Is that a radical climate agenda? Is it like saying you should hire more women than men? Is that wokeness? And so in China, you're not allowed to have your AI talk about Tiananmen Square. And in America, you're not allowed to have your AI talk about solar panels. And so I don't like that at all. Am I wrong?
So I think a big part of, I keep going back to this concept of truth seeking in AI. It's a very complex topic, Nick. And the reason it's complex is what is true for you might not be true for me. And I think one of the things in the AI action plan, which really underscores that, is the scientific ways to measure. And if you read actually right after the woke AI, there's a comment around fairness. So it's not that fairness has gone away. It's certain components of how you're defining woke. I think we're going to see a little bit second level of this AI action plan, where there's going to be a little bit more clear definition of what does that really mean? Having said that, again, everything that we are doing in AI is based on the data sets that we are training. I think that's where we should be spending more time evaluating these data sets. Where are these ideologies coming from? And, you know, I think there needs to be more disclosure and transparency reporting around how these foundation models are being built, what data sets that they've used, and then what kind of testing have they done. And guess what? We don't have those transparency reporting and disclosure reporting. So it's very difficult to figure out how these foundation models are, you know, responding to things that they are and aren't. And I think you and I discuss, this is something that we've been actively working with the government on, more disclosures, more transparency around how these systems are built, so that we can actually start having a more scientific-based conversation around what works and what doesn't work.
Great. Okay, next thing I don't like. So the Trump administration has been gung-ho on preempting state AI regulations, right? And so that this cockamamie idea that was in the Big Beautiful Bill, that any state regulation in AI would be wiped out. Right. And it was kind of put in the bill in the dead of night. Nobody paid attention. It's, I mean, come on, federalist country. Like, what are you talking about? Right. And then it went to it got knocked out 99-1 once people paid attention. Right. But then in the Trump AI regulations, they kind of brought the idea back a little bit. And they said, if any state has AI regulations that slow down innovation, we're going to cut off federal government AI funding. I mean, it's so important that states be able to experiment. Like, I don't know, some states have like laws against AI being used for child pornography, right? Is that anti-innovation because it creates sort of regulation requirements? What about state AI laws like Maine has that mandate that companies using AI like show whether something is human or AI? Like, it's really important to be able to test these things, and this stuff is going to get politicized. So if the Trump administration is going to cut off AI funding, you know it's going to just cut off AI funding to the blue states, right? This is all going to get politicized. It creates a mess. Like, we should just run the country the way we run the country, which the states get to do their stuff, the federal government gets to do their stuff. If they conflict, it goes to the courts. So I didn't like that.
I believe that there is an opportunity, whether it's at state level or whether it's at federal level, to again think about use case level guardrails, context level guardrails, because I don't think there can be a peanut butter approach to regulation. And so we are big proponents, whether it's at state, whether it's at federal, and we'll see whether, you know, how this gets implemented. Obviously, it was removed from, you know, the AI action plan. The moratorium was removed from it for a reason. But I think the key thing here is you cannot have one size fit all for regulation. It has to be very use case and AI sector specific. So we will see. I can't comment on, you know, how it's going to proceed. But I was just happy to see the moratorium not being included in the AI action plan.
Great. Most people, Democrats, Republicans, 98% of Washington believes that we need to cut off China's access to like high-end chips and, you know, basically try to slow China's AI growth as much as possible. I kind of believe that doesn't work, right? And like limiting access to NVIDIA chips only allowed Huawei to start building really high-powered chips. And so if the goal is to have American companies in a free competition system be as effective and successful as possible, we're undermining ourselves. So I kind of lean in that direction. So I was happy that the Trump administration recently lifted the limitations on sort of very high-end NVIDIA chips. So we're not lifting all of the restrictions on exports to China, but some of them. So I was happy about that. Have I misdiagnosed the problem? And what do you think of that?
So I think one of the big focuses of the AI action plan is that the way that United States is going to win is if rest of the world is built on AI, our AI stack, which is world leading. And I believe that, you know, US is right now leading in that space, whether it's from standards, whether it's from technology. On the export control, you know, it's been lifted for older NVIDIA chipsets. I think it's fine. I think what's going to be really key for us to maintain our competitive edge is to make sure all the latest and greatest hardware that is getting built, especially NVIDIA hardware that's getting built, is made available to United States startups. And it is made available to us so that we can actually continue to innovate and continue to lead in this space. So I'm actually very excited to see that provision in the AI action plan as well.
All right. Audience, holy smokes. All right, the entire half of the audience over here, every single person has their hand up, so just throw the mic and see who catches it. Over here somewhere.
Hi, thank you. This has been very interesting. I have a number of questions, but I'm picking one. The comment about women using AI versus men is, if women don't use AI, will that then affect what we then learn when we use AI? If that's clear. So if women don't utilize it and ask their questions and it answers it and then feeds back into the system, will our voices not be heard as AI continues to compute it?
Absolutely. I'll give you a very simple example. You know, early on in my career, I was working on this voice encoder technology. It was like in your cell phones. And the interesting thing was that the technology we were working on, most of my engineering team were men. And so when they were testing that technology out, it worked so perfectly. And then we launched it in one of our early prototypes of cell phone. And what they found was when women were talking on this technology, this voice encoder, it would chop off the high frequency. And the interesting thing was women have high pitches. So now we have never even tested, because women were not part of the engineering team. Women were not part of the test set that we had. So now we've just launched a technology that basically, guess what? You can't even hear the women on the other side. Maybe good for some, but not good for us, right? So yes, I totally believe that if women are not using AI, I don't think this technology is going to benefit us in the future.
Thank you so much for this conversation. So I want to go back to the AI and education question. I'm a PhD student in AI education. And so you guys talked about students using AI to facilitate additional learning rather than for cognitive offloading. But you know what we're really seeing a lot of the time is that adolescents, especially in an increasingly competitive education system, are incentivized to use it for cognitive offloading rather than for constructive learning, as well as they don't necessarily know what constructive learning looks like. And when that happens, you know, we see even that recent Patty Mace paper that came out, the Your Brain on ChatGPT, the major cognitive deficiencies that come from using AI heavily in your education system, especially if you're not using it the quote-unquote right way. So I'm wondering, what do you think is the way that we get students to use it quote-unquote the right way rather than this cognitive offloading that is really more common at this point?
I mean, I don't know how to do it for students. I'm not an academic, but I do talk to my kids. I think that the first point is just to make sure that everybody understands the premises, right? That like AI is an incredibly sharp tool, but if you use it in the wrong ways, you dull the tool of your own mind. And so, you know, what you need to do is you need to figure out, it's interesting, right? So I'll explain how I use it in my life. I just wrote a book about my life running. And I didn't use AI to write a single sentence in the book, right? Because A, I consider that sort of unethical. B, there are potentially copyright reasons. And C, I don't ever want to weaken my ability to write, right? And I know that if I start to use it for writing, what happens with a tool like this is you start to use it for a task. And then in the back of your mind, you start to rely on it for a task. And then you're like, I need to write the next sentence. And you're like, well, maybe I should go to AI, right? And so I'm very focused on not using it for the things that are core to my life and core to what I consider my intelligence. I do use it for the stuff where it's extremely good, right? Like I would upload, there was a woman I interviewed like 10 times over 6 years. I took the section of the book on her. I uploaded all the interview transcripts and I said, does this section accurately reflect everything she said? Are there any quotes of hers that are better than the quotes that I've used? Is there anything factually incorrect? Is there anything where she gave me contradictory answers where I may have chosen one over the other, but human memory is faulty, right? Like the stuff where AI, which can read 10,000 words instantaneously, is extremely good. And that kind of sorting and filtering I don't consider as core to my work. So it's this combination of like using it in the places where I think it can go faster, where it can help me go faster, but where it also doesn't dull the tools of my own mind. So getting that across is extremely important within the educational system. I think you're just going to have to change the way you evaluate, right? It's being used to write papers, and you're going to have people write papers in class, right? You're going to have to observe them. You're going to have to shift from evaluating on written output, which is so easy to fake. You're going to have oral examinations. You're just going to have to change the student-faculty ratio. You're going to have to go to like smaller classes, and like you're just going to have to more of like an Oxford model, right? I'm going to tell you one story that like is amazing. So my wife is a professor and she's a dance historian at the New School, and she has a student come in. A student writes a paper, and clearly not the student, right? Like she's been talking to the student. The student doesn't write like this. The student doesn't know a lot about the topic they wrote about. And so my wife brings the student in. She's like, you can't use AI to write your paper. And the student's like, no, I didn't use AI. And she's like, no, let's not joke around. Like, I know you used AI on this, right? It's clear, you know, but let's talk through and, you know, have a reasonable conversation. Like, no, I really didn't use AI. I mean, who are you kidding? Okay, I didn't use AI. I hired a tutor to write the paper for me, and maybe they used AI. Anyway, so it's just to say the educational system has some troubles.
I want to step back to the climate and clean energy aspect of this. I'm the director of energy here at COA, and looking at the Paris Climate Agreement and the best available science, like globally, we need to cut fossil fuel consumption 50%, including not just buildings, but transportation and electricity and across the board by 2030, which is ticking away very, very quickly. And so I think that it's important to not look at the AI regulations and the executive orders in isolation, but to look at them alongside the executive orders and the things that Trump has said relating to energy, where he's gutted all the support for solar and wind and has thrown, he's gone all in on fossil fuels, which they've had a 100-year head start on renewable energy, and they don't need any additional government support. At the same time, we're seeing these big tech companies who a decade ago were the leaders on clean energy, and many of them made commitments for 100% clean energy 10 to 20 or more years ago and had met their commitments, who are now rolling back on that and saying, oh, well, in order to support AI, we need more natural gas power plants, or, oh, we're going to go to nuclear energy. And so we're seeing this explosion in demand that is, they're firing up the dirtiest fossil fuel power plants. And so to me, like in terms of being a company that's at the forefront of how AI can be positive for people, not destroying the planet, not destroying human life as we know it, seems like a pretty important aspect of that. So how do you see it as your responsibility to ensure that your company and the companies you work with are not just optimistic about meeting the climate goals, but are actually meeting the goals that scientists tell us are essential, like transitioning off of fossil fuels by 2040.
Thank you for that question. And you know, I think these kind of questions keep us accountable. We are not experts in this space, but one of the things that we are trying to do is there's this new concept of energy star rating for AI use. So as an example, and this might be a little bit outdated stat already, but if you're prompting GPT, like just one single prompt, that's like taking around 16 ounces of water and just throwing it on the ground, and it just goes to waste, right? Or it's, if you think about one prompt, it's powering like 250 houses in United States. So we take that responsibility very seriously. So one of the things that we've been doing is working with companies to understand how these systems use is, by the way, impacting energy consumption. But the second is leading with transparency. So this Energy Star rating is the first attempt to make sure every time we are using a foundation model, whether you're using a ChatGPT or any other system, that as the end user actually get visibility into how much energy are they using. There's a bunch of researchers and we are trying to progress this, but the idea there is if I'm the end user and I'm using these very smart systems for my daily use, can I actually get my own carbon footprint of use of these technologies? I think only when can we clearly state what is my carbon footprint using these technologies can we take action. So that's our first step, but I'm open to other ideas that might be possible.
I'm also just going to add, like, I praise the Trump's AI regulations. It's catastrophic for the climate and idiotic for the American economy to, cut subsidies and cut support for solar. Last in May, China created enough new solar panels and solar energy to match the entire energy output of Mexico. That's what just China built, created, and made in May. Like, this is going to power economies of the future, and we are offloading it to China. And so it's not just a bad environmental decision at a time where we need good environmental decisions. It is a bad economic decision.
We'll take one more question,
Sean.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hi, I'm a big proponent of scientific and technological development. I am concerned that if to be successful, if the predictor of being successful in the future is being proficient in AI, and our country already has a huge economic wealth gap and a huge gap in access to quality education, will all of those people be left behind, or what is the solution to that? Thank you.
I love that question because that is top of concern for me as well. You know, it's we can say a lot about AI literacy program, workforce development, but we need to have the budgets to be able to do that. So that is something that we are actively working on, whether it's working with our customers in education or it's working with government to mandate the upskilling and AI literacy programs. But I'll be honest with you, like where, if there are communities who don't even have the basic broadband access, I mean, forget like getting AI access, don't have accurate solutions, but we are trying to do our bit in the communities that we are working in. But yes, I share your concern as well.
I'd also just add, this could go either way, right? The last tech revolution sort of consolidated wealth, power, influence in a very small segment of society, small number of corporate winners that didn't employ that many people per, you know, unit of output. AI could go that way or it could go the other way, right? And you've seen like studies in Nigeria, the educational improvement that comes with using AI as a tutor. Everybody in the world, if they have broadband, if they have a device, right, will have access to the most incredible set of tutors and the most incredible opportunity to learn, right? And who knows whether everybody will have access and who knows who'll actually use this. But the capacity for anywhere in the world to learn incredible things very quickly with AI is a new thing for us. And there is a chance, I don't think it's a likely chance, but it's definitely a chance that this ends up improving equity.
Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's program was the fifth in a six-part series from the 2025 College of the Atlantic Summer Institute and featured a discussion between Credo AI founder and CEO Navreena Singh and CEO of the Atlantic Nick Thompson about the future of AI. This talk was recorded on August 1, 2025 in Bar Harbor, Maine. Today's episode is available on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on Shows to find Speaking in Maine and many other on-demand programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Susan Tran is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and today's program was produced by me, Jane Donahue. Thanks for joining us. This is Maine Public Radio.